Thank you very much, David. It's a great pleasure, and I apologize for having sort of imposed my little visit, but I was in the area, and I have very good, memories of my staying in Santa Barbara in the 80s, because I was running out of problems, and so I took a leave in the mid-80s and spent a few months here. The institute was at the other building, and here I came to know fractals and all this field that for me was rather pleasant, so I have very good intellectual experience here. I see that in the meantime it has only gone better, so I congratulate with this beautiful institute. But let me go into the matter. May I ask you how many of you work in the field of ITC? Well, you know, no shame, nobody is perfect, you know. You should. Okay, so one or two, I guess, from the embarrassment. So, okay, I make it a little bit interesting also for the non-experts, hopefully. And then if you want to go into more technical, I'm still here for an hour or so after the talk, then I have to leave. So everything started in 86 with the work of Alex Mueller. I mean, this is very well known, but I recall you this for a specific reason. You see, in addition to the oxides, first, I think this diagram, it probably doesn't mean anything, but on the other hand, it's very fascinating for various reasons. So this is how TC evolved with time. I mean, in 1911, it was discovered by Cramer-Digon superconductivity, then it went on for many years, more or less linearly in time, you see, like this. Then there was a big discrepancy with 86, the discovery. Now it's up to 160. And then there was another category, the C60 compounds, that go up to 35 about, you see, from 10 to 35. Now, the big question is, well, first notice one point, that, you know, at the point when the microscopic theory was made, you see, this point corresponds to a plateau in the increase of TC. You see, so it seems that it is bad to have a theory to improve TC, one could argue like this. Then you have the oxides, which are this big peak, and certainly this behavior and this peak cannot be the same thing. But a more puzzling issue is the C60 compounds. I mean, can these compounds be somehow the continuation of this line, or they belong to this, or we need three theories? So the question is, do we need, so to say, two theories, you see, two theories in the sense that this is the continuation of this, so it's the standard theory, and this is another story, or two theories in the sense that this belongs to this, or three theories, maybe. You see, this is a little bit... Usually, people don't talk anymore in this framework, I mean, that to mix C60 with the oxides, for reasons that we will understand. But my opinion in this respect is that still there are many, many analogies, much more than the differences, in many ways. Yeah, the buckyballs. Let's see why one can think there are analogies. You see, there is this is an experimental plot made by Uemura of Columbia, and there's a plot of transition temperature versus relaxation rate of the magnetic penetration. It's a rather well-known plot because it's experimental versus experimental, and you see, these buckyballs are just in the middle of a sort of the exotic family. Why the BCS materials, you see, this is broken, would be a little bit farther. So it seems like there is a family of normal superconductors and another family of exotic superconductors in which the buckyball is just together with the oxides and with other, here are also what are called the heavy fermion metals. Sorry? Relaxation rate is has to do with the magnetic penetration depth. It's a measurement which is supposed to be related to density of carriers divided effective mass. But in any case, whatever it is an experiment. You see, so this plot is not coming from a model. It's a piece of nature that you see in front of you. And this piece of nature, for what it means, that we don't know exactly, it suggests us that there is a family in which the C60 belongs together with the oxides, and another family far away, which is the BCS family. Please. Well, yes, as you can define a phase transition. So, yes. Well, the same way as you can define a phase transition in a finite system. I mean, it's a phase transition. So, can you define order, disorder, transition, freezing in a finite system? Well, the drop in resistivity is not the characteristic. No, I mean, let me make clear. Your question doesn't refer only to superconductivity, but to all phase transition, right? So it's correct, or you are referring it especially to superconductivity. So one refers to all phase transition in the sense that 10 to the 23, which is the number of atoms in a cubic centimeter, for most physical property is infinite. So in the same sense as superconductivity. It can be that for some particular situation it's not infinite 10 to the 23, and then you may have pathologies. Was this your question? No. But that's not... No, it's a solid made of buckyball, doped. Yes. No, the buckyball is like a... No. The buckyball... This is... they are not super... Well, that is another story whether you can talk about... No, okay, sorry, I misunderstood. Okay, so then you can make a little bit an interpretation now of the axis, and you interpret as a Fermi energy, you see. So here you interpret as a Fermi energy, and then you can see that, for example, one characteristic of the anomalous things is to have a relatively low Fermi energy. Why, this is now log space, so the normal thing came closer, but I mean, it's still one or two orders of magnitude. Okay, so for example, this would be an indication to argue that at least there are some elements in the C60. Now, what are the differences? Since the oxide came first, then people went mostly into diverging routes. Well, the fact is that the oxides are very close to magnetic states, to magnetic phases, and there is almost no isotope effect in the optimized systems, while C60 has a large isotope effect. The isotope effect is a proof that phonons are relevant. So in some sense, for C60, it's unavoidable to think at phonons, and for the same reason, so to say, for the others, it was somehow abandoned a little bit the phonon hypothesis, even though there are isotope effects also in the oxides, but usually the isotope effect is smaller at the optimum concentration. The higher TC, the smaller the isotope effect for oxides. So you see, this led to two different paths, in which, however, C60 had to be considered as part of the old theory. So let's see the old theory. You see, the simplest BCS is the one you see upstairs. Of course, nobody would like to interpret any data with that. That is just to teach the students. Because, you know, with that you could immediately explain 100 degrees. You know, you have omega of 500, lambda of 1, so to say, so you get ITC. You see, well, obviously you don't get. So you have to make a more refined theory to discuss numbers. That is the Migdal-Eliasberg, so you include many body effects. And in doing this, you see, this is all based on a certain expansion called Migdal's theorem, Migdal the father, so to say, Arcady, I think, Migdal, and this requires the concept of adiabaticity, that electrons and phonons are decoupled, I mean, are somehow dynamically decoupled, so phonons have much smaller energy than electrons. So this is the basis of everything, and now let's go for a moment to oxides, and then I go a little bit up and down, okay? So this is a phase diagram of oxides now. This is a big mess. It's also turned around to make it more confused. No, it's to right, on the right, okay? So what happens, you see, this is TC and this is doping. When you have very large doping, you have a normal metal. So a normal metal of this type is very lousy BCS, so it makes TC equal 0. Then you enter a region in which you do have superconductivity, and essentially it's the only anomalous thing you have. You see, this would be the overdoped phase. Then you enter a region in which you have a hell of a lot of a mess, that is the underdoped, in which you get stripes, pseudo-gap, all sorts of things, polarons, spin glasses eventually, etc. Then everything disappears, in the sense of propagating states, and you go into things like antiferromagnetic things. Now, most of the people, the way to read this diagram that I will propose you is a little bit different than most of the talks you may have seen, because you see, most of the talks are done like this. Well, you see, this is, here you have nothing, so this is not interesting, you see, in the overdoped. Let's go and check for stripes. Maybe stripes that we observe here, you can do experiments, publish a lot of papers. So maybe stripes are the smoking gun. And then from this they say what the stripes can do, etc. I propose you a different way to read this diagram and a different logic. What we care is not stripes, we care for superconductivity. So if there is a region in which there is superconductivity, yes, and stripes, no, this is the most interesting region, because this tells you immediately, or at least indicates to you, that these stripes are not so crucial for superconductivity. So what the hell is crucial? Well, if you go in the underdoped, you see, you get obscured by all these instabilities. But if you go to the overdoped, you essentially don't have instabilities, but you have an anomalous situation. The anomalous situation is that, you have a sort of complex Fermi liquid with large Coulomb interaction and with a situation in which the Fermi energy is very small. So the adiabatic parameter, omega zero, phonon, or whatever, interaction, is different from zero. So you see, that's what you have. And when the system degrades even more, then this this type of physics becomes destructive and breaks down by changing the ground state. For example, you have opposite effects, for example, for the pseudo-gap NTC, you can see, for example, from the isotope effect. The isotope effect decreases the T-star of pseudo-gap and increases the one of TC. So one would say that there are many indications, or at least the majority of indications, are that these things, like stripes and pseudo-gap, are negative, namely are those that make TC to go down. There are also some positive indications, but to me the most strong one is that in the overdose these things are not present. Then, let me make a little review for those who are not experts of what have been the main experiments of the past year or so. So the field is undergoing from the emotion of the first 10 years, so the enthusiasm of the beginner, to a sort of more mature situation. But I think it's very interesting because the experiments are of high quality, and as you will see, some of these experiments have ruled out theories that have somehow been very popular for many years. So the first is that one observes certain isotope effects both on TC and T star, you see, which could be understood somehow in the oxide, say, in the non-optimized oxide, but also one observes an isotope effect in M star, in the effective mass of the single electron. Now, this is beyond Fermi liquid, and this is in a situation in which, in some sense, the oxides now are puzzling, because on one hand, they have very little isotope effect where they should be, in the sense of phonons, and this has led to think at the Hubbard mostly. On the other hand, now they show an isotope effect where there shouldn't be one, so in M star, which is not present in the standard thing. Then there's been detailed pressure and strain effects. You see, first pressure was studied globally. You just put global pressure in the system and see the global effect. Now people could do very smart experiments in which either they press single layers or they press layers one against each other. Now, you see, this was very surprising because it showed that pressing layers one against each other, TC is actually reduced, while pressing a single layer, TC is enhanced. Together with the analysis, the beautiful experiment of van der Maarder and others on the analysis of Josephson coupling, I would say these two experiments rule out the Anderson theory in its full version, namely the one in which you have interlayer tunneling, and I think he basically agrees that this has to be now abandoned. So you see, the theory was that you have confinement in the layer, so electrons split in holons and spinons, and then they can only pair in pairs, and then this pairing between layers, so somehow the pairing between layers should give a Josephson coupling of the order of the superconducting transition, and should give a positive effect for the pressure. So this seems to be against, so this one has to change. Please. No, single layer means, it's not a single layer, it means pressure that presses only in a layer. A multi-layer, yes. No, the picture is, I should have made the picture better. There are actually, the word single layer appears in this field. It appears in two ways. One, putting one layer on a substrate. Okay, there are indications that this is also superconductor, but of the question is debated. The other word in which, the other way in which single layer appears is single layer per unit cell. You see, so when you have three layers or so, then you have a big block of other ionic material and another three layer. If you have a single layer per unit cell, this means that the interlayer transition is much, much smaller than if you have many layers. So also in that case, in systems with one layer per unit cell, a temperature of 92 was observed, which also would be too high to explain if the mechanism is interlayer, it's already high TC. So this is another, but this is an indication, this measurement. So I would say the two strong elements are these ones. Then there is another interesting measurement in about a year ago, in which the magnetic field suppresses TC, but leaves the pseudo gap unchanged. So this means that the pseudo gap is most likely not the sort of the shadow of superconductivity about TC, but is some other thing, possibly a Mott transition. So these are all experiments that, if confirmed and so on, they give you a very precise picture. Then there is, for example, the study of non-magnetic impurities. You see, non-magnetic impurities should not affect BCS superconductivity, while they do affect superconductivity both in the oxides and in C60. In the oxides, one may argue, if it is D-wave, then this argument, it's not true, the standard argument. For D-wave, non-magnetic impurity can affect. But C60 is S-wave. So you see, we have a puzzling thing that non-magnetic impurity affect an S-wave superconductivity, which in the case of C60 is certainly due to phonons. So this is one additional, very specific puzzle. Then there is the development of additional materials like C36 and C24, which, however, still did not lead to a solid. So for the moment, it's still a little, to a conducting solid. So now let's go to C60. C60 appeared as a textbook molecular crystal. You see, these are the molecular levels that split when you make a bend. And so you just make a little bit of splitting and you charge it a little bit. So, for example, this band here has three orbitals with two spin each, so it has a total of six electrons. The picture you see is if you dope with three electrons. So this would be K3C60, what you see here. You see, interesting is to note that the Fermi energy is very, very small. It's 0.2 V. So it's completely different than a normal metal where it is from 2 to 5 eV. So what we would expect then? That normal C60 has the Fermi energy here. Once you dope it with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you fill these levels, and eventually you go to a new insulator. So you would expect that non-doped is an insulator, that's correct. Doped with 6 is another insulator, that's also correct. And in the middle is always a metal, and that's wrong, because experiments don't show this. Only 3 is a metal, but we'll come back into this. Now, one thing people studied a lot was the dependence on TC on the lattice constant. And this also gave rise, this can be understood with normal concepts, so I don't go into the argument, it's fairly simple. So this was an element to argue in favor of a normal interpretation of C60 based on something like BCS. From various experiments, one could argue the following, that you have a Fermi liquid, a correlated Fermi liquid, you have narrow bands and small carriers, but certainly you have electron-phonon coupling because the isotope effect is very large. So this pointed to a normal story. The problem, however, yes, well, suppose that the energetic is spin energy. If you change the isotope of the atom, this should not change the energetic of the spin. You see, so the isotope effect comes in the change of the phonon frequency. But if you have another physics that is not so dependent on the phonon frequency, it shouldn't do anything. So this is, if you have a very small one, you see, you have to read it in this way. 0.5 would be the ideal BCS. If you put many body effects, it goes down a little bit, like 0.3, 0.4. So 0.3, 0.4 is typical of a realistic Migdal-Eliasberg. To get the same from another energy, it would be very, very weird. Because, I mean, there is no way to change so much the energy, for example, of spin interaction by changing the phonon frequency. So, unless you somehow make very weird hypotheses, this is a very strong indication for the phonon. The opposite is not necessarily true, that if you do not have an isotope effect, you can exclude phonons, because, I mean, the many body reasons tend to decrease the isotope effect. However, what made people suspicious that C60 may not be so simple, you see, was the fact that, as I discussed from the little diagram, you see, we would expect all this to be metallic, A1, A4, also A2, while only A3, A would be, for example, sodium, potassium, for example. So, you see, this is clearly indication of many body effects. So, you see, C60 with this picture begins to get close to the oxides. Namely, the phase diagram is very complex and cannot be understood unless you put in heavily like terms like carbon or things like that. Actually, it's even more complex because in the spirit of the Mott transition, you would have that the most unstable situation is the half-filled. So, in case we would expect that our field is an insulator, and when you deviate from our field, it may be metallic. So, this people tend to explain with the mix of Jan Teller and Hubbard interaction, but I think there is no consensus. In any case, this situation shows that you don't have at all a simple story. Now, what you can do, however, is to compare the C60 with the doped graphite. Now, doped graphite is a very interesting material that was studied in the end of the 70s to make a synthetic metal. You see, you can have, for example, KC8, this is doped graphite. Graphite is a layer system, so now you have an extended system doped as much as C60, which is instead a molecule. So, in one case you have extended bands, in the other case you have molecular crystal with little hopping. But, you see, basically, you can reach, by this type of doping, about the same amount of density of states. The strange thing, however, is that while C60 gets into this very high range of temperatures, doped graphite stays below 1 Kelvin. So there is a factor 200 between two systems, which in many cases, for many properties, are very similar. We can go through a little analysis. You see, the maximum, the bifrequency is the same. The density of states is about the same. Maybe C60 has a little more, but this brought through. The residual Coulomb interaction is certainly much worse for C60 because it doesn't have an extended band, so dynamical screening is much less. This has been computed. So you see, to fit the data means a very small TC here and the large TC here, because from what we see here, we would predict that graphite is better than C60 as far as superconductivity. So to fit the data, you have to make an enormous difference in the coupling. Now, this is very unrealistic, and I think it's not the way to go. So it's not a matter of numbers. Moreover, I would say this is not the way to look at this interpretation. But apart from numbers, let's see what do we have qualitatively. You see, in graphite we have a sort of a single energy scale, the coupling between the carbon atoms. And this single energy scale gives rise to both density of states and electron-phonon coupling. In fullerenes, we have two energy scales. We have the energy scale within a buckyball, which leads to essentially to a relatively large electron-phonon coupling, as large as the graphite, is the same type of physics. And then we have a small energy scale, which is absent in graphite, which is responsible for the Fermi surface. So you see, in some sense, we have separate effects in the buckyball. One leads to the coupling, and the other leads to the Fermi surface. In graphite, we have the same energy scale, which leads to both. So how can this be lead to a difference? Well, let me make a little remark of why the buckyball. So what I'm trying to convince you is that the buckyball cannot be interpreted in any way along the standard theory. But to do this, I invoke the rules of a big expert, Ben Matthias, who was nearby in La Jolla, and he was the guy who made the highest TC of the slow TC. So he could invent tricks to make the ISTC. So he made the niobium compounds up to 23. He had empirical rules that were a little bit due to physics. Physics in this case would be Migdal-Eliasberg equation, which are rather messy. So if you really go into the meanders of Migdal-Eliasberg equation, it's not so easy to pick rules. So he had rules that we can easily interpret in terms of Migdal-Eliasberg, and as a good magician, he had rules that are ununderstandable to us normal people. But out of these rules, he made the materials. So the rules are the following. High symmetry is the best. This can be understood a little bit. I mean, because, okay, you have more density of states. And transition metal compounds, and density of state peaks. So these are sort of band structure effects. Then stay away from oxygen. This I don't really understand. I mean, okay. Stay away from magnetism. This is clear, you see, because magnetism destroys the Cooper pair. Stay away from insulators. This is also clear, because, I mean, the more you are close to insulator, the less you have screening, so all things become bad. And the last one is stay away from theorists, because they make you waste time, you see. These were the rules of Matthias as published. I found this in a paper. Now, you see, with these rules, he did all this nice material development that led to Tc equal 23 in the standard material. But in summary, you see, what one can make if we summarize this rule in one meta rule, the small density of states is very bad for the standard theory, you see. The small density. Now, so how is it possible that C60 with 20 times density of with 20 times number of carriers than the normal metal is the best not traditional material? This is something very implausible. But apart from this consideration, it is unavoidable that there is a problem, because you see the basis of the many body theory is the neglect of the vertex correction. This was the so-called Migdal theorem. The vertex correction is not of higher order with respect to self-energy. You see, it's the same order of self-energy in terms of decoupling, but it gets this omega over EF term, and because of this is neglected. This is what is called Migdal theorem or Migdal approximation. Now, we can go into the materials, and we see that in graphite we have a very large Fermi energy, and a relatively small phonon energy, and so it's okay, but for C60 we have that they are of the same value. So you see, in any case, even if one tries to fiddle parameters, in the end, the parameters will be such that the theory which is used is intrinsically inconsistent. So all this is to convince you that, at least if one goes in the field from the perspective of C60, that for strange personal reasons is my experience, you see, the fact that it is obvious to go into Hubbard, well, it is not so obvious. Certainly, Hubbard is there, is behind the phase diagram of the oxides and also behind the phase diagram of the C60. On the other hand, C60 forces you to take phonons a little more serious, but not in the standard sense, in the sense of non-Born-Oppenheimer or non-Migdal version. So Migdal's theorem, for those of you who are not familiar, is the Feynman diagram version of the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. I mean, for somehow. That's why non-adiabatic. So, a little more technically, so the breakdown of Migdal's theorem happens if this parameter is non-zero, if you have small Q scattering, well, this I have not time now to go in detail, but, and if you have Vanove singularities. Because effectively, locally, if you have small Q scattering of Vanove, the local parameter is zero. Now, all these three situations are realized in Heisenberg-produced superconductors, by the way. So, in practice, what does this mean? If we want now to try, let's include Migdal's theorem. If this, what you see here, is the Migdal-Eliasberg theory, for those who are familiar. So, you see, you have the anomalous scattering, and you resum in a Dyson equation the exchange of a phonon. Now, what you would like to do is to generalize this theory, you see, this theory, to generalize to the first vertex correction, the second vertex correction, the cross diagram. This is the first systematic addition of processes that go in the direction of non-adiabaticity. What does it mean, for example, with respect to polarons? Because people say, well, when you have a breakdown in that respect, you go to polarons. Well, you don't go to polarons, because, you see, this is usually not considered. So you have two directions. Actually, you would have three directions, but to make it simple, let's make two. You have lambda and omega 0 over EF. The usual discussion is always made at omega 0 where EF equals 0. So we have this discussion. So you start BCS at small lambda. Make the Eliasberg a little bit larger lambda. In any case, make the parameter equal 0. Then polaron, bipolaron, large lambda. You see, now that's not the direction we want to go. We want to go in another direction in which lambda remains moderate and omega over EF is non-zero. This means that you can still have propagating electrons in a non-Fermi liquid situation because of non-adiabaticity that do not go into the polaronic instability. So in this respect, there is a new way. Okay, I mean, I have some technical things, but I don't. So basically, first you should recompute all the diagrams within the new methods. So you don't have to use adiabaticity in the calculation of the old diagram. Okay, that's just technical. What? The small parameter for this diagram is the product of lambda multiplied omega 0 over EF. You see? So you are somewhere here, and then you have the product of these two is the coupling of the new elements. Oh, it depends. Well, but it could be, let's say, this could be 0.5 and this could be 0.3. I mean. But the product of 0.5 by 0.3 is not so. But let me make an argument about the question of... because on this, for example, I had long discussions with Phil Anderson some time ago. Now, what are we doing here? You see, we are trying to move from the adiabatic theory into the non-adiabatic theory. Now, this suppose that the materials are in the non-perturbative regime. Okay, that means we are not really getting there, okay? But what is important, this is relatively non-important, I mean, what is important is that the perturbative approach makes sense mathematically, so that it is a stable thing, that if you have a material with a small parameter, that this makes sense, not that there is an opening up of a ladder diagram that kills everything. So in this respect, the theory is stable. So it makes sense to consider somehow perturbatively these effects. And even if the system, and the way we are going to use this is in the following sense. We are going to find which properties of the materials are such that with respect to the opening of this new path, they will be favorable. Now, it is plausible that even when you go into non-perturbative, this sort of qualitative behavior of material will remain the same. But, okay, this is open question. You see, let me add a final comment. If we estimate the parameter of the material for this type of generalization, actually the perturbative approach is quite reasonable, I mean it's realistic. Namely, we believe that in C60, for example, we believe that in C60 lambda is of the order of 0.5 and omega 0 over EF effective, I mean not the maximum, but the average is of the order of 0.2, 0.3. So you have that the product is of order 1/10, so you see you don't have one. But in any case, let me put it this way, it's a path one has to go. I mean, you cannot hope, you know, to somehow, it's about, so in this respect, it is important that it makes sense, I mean, that is sort of healthy and not a sick method. Okay, then you can do a full calculation of the diagram with some approximation. It depends, you can do numeric, etc. But let's discuss this, which is better. So this is the sign of the main contribution, which is characteristic of all the first order non-adiabatic effects. So you can see that the sign is a function of Q and omega. So we are talking about this function here. You see, as a function of omega and Q, these are parameters, and these are functional dependence. So as a function of Q and omega, you see that there is half of it which is negative and half of it which is positive. So the inclusion of non-adiabatic effects not necessarily leads to an improvement. I mean, here the sign is chosen so that positive means that TC increases. Okay, that's how it is. So what does it mean that if you have a material in which mostly you have small Q scattering, you see, the material will be located mostly in this region, then you have an increase from this phenomenon. If you have a material which is mostly large Q scattering, you have the opposite. So this means that the non-adiabaticity is not a general recipe for everything, but you have to complement it with some specific material property. And that's what we have been trying to do in the past years. Let me make a little pictorial diagram. So this is the space of theories. Okay, so this is BCS theory. Then this is the Migdal-Eliasberg. So these are still the adiabatic theories. So in this theory, omega over EF is zero. Then you can go to non-adiabatic in the way we are studying, or in the Polaron way, for example. And, okay, these are two different ways. In our way, then, you have to add things like electron correlation and Vanove, the specific property of material, to decide which is the region of parameters you are. Of course, also, you better do something like, predict some experiment. This is a detailed study with, I think, numerical Monte Carlo to discuss the phase diagram of the polarons versus the behavior of this correlated Fermi, non-adiabatic fermions. So, okay, this is just a confirmation that this regime exists in the Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo. Then, okay, up to now, you see, we have gone quite a path in the generalization of the adiabatic story. But now we have to also put the Coulomb interaction. So the Coulomb interaction, we begin to put it in a sort of perturbative way also. So if you have Coulomb interaction, you have the so-called correlation hole. And the scattering matrix element will be affected by the correlation hole, actually by the Fourier transform of it, the structure factor. So this means that, there are many studies, but if you have strong Coulomb interaction, the electron-phonon matrix element of a correlated Fermi liquid, you see, is mostly small q. This has been shown by various authors. And there are many, you can also intuitively see, because what's the problem? If you have Coulomb interaction, you see, large q means small space. Small space means they repel. Okay, so as soon as you add a strong Coulomb interaction, the scattering is mostly at small q. But this brings us exactly in our favorable regime. So the total coupling in this perspective, you see, is an attraction at small q and some residual repulsion at large q. And this naturally leads to D. It depends on the nature, on the value of parameters. It may lead to D or S, but it is natural also to lead to D. So this means that, you see, what if we move from a standard Fermi liquid towards a correlated Fermi liquid, first we have small q scattering when we are still in the evolutive regime. When we go into the non-analytic, when we have some breakdown, we may have antiferromagnetism, stripes, phase separation, charge density wave. So we believe that now we are going to use the upper part of this thing, you see, before the breakdown. So this is when the thing gets somehow important in the Fermi liquid behavior, and this is when the thing is so important that it has destroyed the Fermi liquid behavior. So we are going to use it before the destruction. So in our opinion, this property of correlation is positive, and when it leads to this type of degradation, then it's negative. Well, most authors today, they tend to pick one of these and argue that that is the smoking gun. So for us, this is the smoking gun to kill, not to enhance superconductivity. Okay, well, I think more or less you got the idea. Of course, there is a lot of other work to compare with the experiments and so on. I just show you a few things. Well, for example, for example, you see, this measurement of effective mass where the, of isotope effect where there shouldn't be one, you see, via the penetration depth again by Mueller and collaborators, this is something that up to now has been only interpreted in terms of polarons. But then the polarons have a lot of other problems. I would say the polaron by polaron theory is not very likely for a variety of reasons. There is a Fermi surface and so on and so forth. So you see, this remains as a very puzzling situation. But And it is certainly impossible to explain with an adiabatic framework. So, in our way, you see, this you can explain, because this means that the self-energy acquires an extra term. You see, this means that we have this extra term in the self-energy for the normal electron, and this gives a sort of a dependence on the phonon frequency of the effective mass. So, you see, this is our type of explanation, and this would be the polaron-bipolaron. You see, on the other hand, the problem with the interpretation of polaron-bipolaron that numerically can be interpreted is that, you see, Tc of superconductivity should go like 1 over m star in the Bose condensation, and that's not what one observes, you see, right? Because in experiments, the isotope effect of Tc is completely different than the one of m star. And this degree of freedom is not present in the bipolar condensation, why it is present in our approach. So in our opinion, for example, this is a rather meaningful experiment to in favor of this point of view. The other experiment is was the fact that you remember there is the story that non-magnetic impurities cannot ruin superconductivity, but one observes this effect in the oxides, and there it is explained by the D wave anyhow, so independent on the microscopic mechanism, but one observes it also in the C60, where it's not explained because C60 is S wave. So also in the non-adiabatic theory, you can have that the non-magnetic impurities have an effect on Tc. So the so-called theorem by which this is impossible is not true anymore. So this is another element that is good. So to make it, of course, what we are doing now is to identify a variety of new experiments. For example, it would be very nice if people would be able to synthesize a metallic C36, because in that system you can change, for example, the change of curvature and maybe a different coupling and a different Fermi energy. So this would be, it seems it may be possible. For the moment, they only could make insulators. So in summary, you see, there, my point is, if you look at the system, at the superconductivity from the point of view of C60 and the oxides, there are certainly two basic parameters that are different from the standard story. One is the celebrated Abbard interaction. The other is the less known or less considered, adiabatic parameter, which certainly for C60 is an unavoidable generalization. So in this perspective, then you can see that C60 and the oxides are very much together, because for both you have very small carrier density. You see, for both, and this is a natural thing. How do you explain the small carrier density in positive? Well, to get access to the non-adiabatic regime, you have to have a small Fermi energy. So in this respect, the small carrier density is necessary to break the Fermi liquid in the sense of non-adiabaticity. But, you see, I am not here telling this is now the theory of what, I don't know, experiments will tell us. What I'm going to say is that often the path that one takes in developing some theoretical approach depends on the personal feeling of experiments, materials, and so on. I came through this field by looking first at C60 and then at the oxides, and this to me is a reasonable path, as reasonable as the alternative one. At least one can do calculation and check with the experiment. Thank you very much for your attention. No, the parameters, what we want to do now is to make a sort of microscopic analysis of everything. So, the parameters will be, the elements of the game will be U, so the Coulomb interaction, from which you get essentially two things. You get the wave function renormalization that tells you how much is the propagating part of your Green function, what is the polar part. So this tells you something like NS. the total number of carriers, and then it gives you G of Q, which is somehow the structure for the interaction. Then the other parameter is that also is depending on this, is somehow parameters like band structure effect, that would be EF, you see, and omega zero. So I would say with these elements we should be able to make a reasonable story. But now, for example, at the moment we are parameterizing this with just one number, QC, while we would go one step back and use this to predict a little bit everything. So you see, the difficult thing up to now has been to find experiments that would be a yes or no answer. I think for each experiment this is very difficult to get. I mean, but the globality, if you take, you know, five or six experiments together, then you can see that one picture may make more sense than the other. You see, in this respect, superconductivity, you may allow me a little metaphor of literature. There is a very famous movie by the Japanese Kurosawa, is Run, I think, the movie. Do you know Run? In Run, there is a murder, and there are four or five witnesses, and each is completely honest, but tells a completely different story. A little bit, the experiments in superconductivity are... Sorry? Rashomon? Yeah, probably. No, Run is another movie. Yeah. Rashomon, right. So, you see, the experiments of superconductivity are a bit like this, because each experiment you can see in different facets, but the globality of the experiment may be they will give us a convergence. In any case, I think the experiment I showed at the beginning of this past year have been extremely useful to eliminate and to cut and to suggest. So I think if there will be maybe 10 more experiments like that, we may eventually converge at least on the essential mechanism. But you see, this will... Of course, you know, we are under the hypothesis that the explanation is sort of simple, even though I don't know whether you would call this simple, but I mean, I would say, if you talk to Alex Müller, he disagrees. He would say it is necessary an infinite amount of material parameter. This would be very bad for theoretical physics. So we look for the key under the lamp, I mean, a little bit. Namely, we look for explanations that would be meaningful theoretically, that have, you can make a story. Yes, well, this, of course, is the... But, you see... Now, of course, this is the objective. I mean, this is the objective. However, if you think at this, you see, this did not happen. You see, it's interesting. Why it did not happen? Because intuitively, I mean, empirically, people had found out what was good and what was bad, and they had already explored, even though in a random sense. So the BCS theory made a sort of... allowed you to understand why if you put this is better and if you put that is worse. But it did not really lead to new material. Now, I would not say that we have this understanding for these systems. For example, you see, in our perspective, I didn't make it too long, so you can indulge into a little bit prejudices and things like that. So, what See, why people are so to say, polarized towards the non-Fermi liquid in the sense of the Hubbard? Well, of course, the reason is that they consider 150 absolutely outside the phonon range, first. Then there was the vicinity of antiferromagnetism, and so on and so forth. However, consider one thing, that the non-Fermi liquid state, the natural non-Fermi liquid state, is an insulator. I mean, what those we know for sure are the Anderson localization, which is localization, and the Mott insulator, which is an insulator. So, to my criteria, a proof that the theory requires a sort of non... You see, what we have done is an analytic complexification of the Fermi liquid. So it's non-Fermi liquid, but in a sort of non-destructive way. It's an evolutionary theory. Yes, and no, because the definition of Fermi liquid is adiabatic, you see, in the books. Okay, I don't care about definition, but I mean, you see, so technically speaking, this is beyond Fermi liquid. But what, for example, people like Phil Anderson have been praising is that you have a complete breakdown of the Fermi liquid ground state and you have to go to another type of world. Now, I think, certainly it's impossible to solve this problem by deduction, you know, take Hamiltonian and deduction. So I think it is good to have biodiversity, you know, we have taken a path, they have taken another, then we will measure. I have no opinion how far you go with the other point of view, but certainly I have shown you why I've taken this point of view and why this, at least for C60, looks to me a very solid approach, I mean, perspective. How far from C60 you go to the others? But so in my perspective, the important elements have been the following. Why the hell you profit from very few carriers? You see, this is a big, big mystery from almost any point of view. And the non-adiabaticity gives you an answer. I mean, because to enter the regime of non-adiabaticity, you have to have a small Fermi energy. And so that's the positive thing. You see, in any other way, you have said that somehow this is a drawback and you have to compensate with some other very large favorable parameter. And the other thing is that, for example, if we take the phase diagrams, you see, it is always, well, this is valid for both, for C60 and for the oxides. You take this phase diagram, you see, the situation is that when you have superconductivity, you also have a metal. Never happens that you have an insulator that leads to superconductivity by lowering temperature. So, of course, people would say, but you have a very lousy metal. So, the question is now, you put accent on the word lousy or you put accent on the word metal? Okay, I have tended to put accent on the word metal because of the analogy with C60. So, okay, who knows? I mean, I think it's valid to explore also the other path, obviously, and I think what focus should be made on the prediction and the tests. So in this perspective, for example, okay, let me now be a little more explicit. How do you make better materials? Okay, fine. So at least for C60, I can give you a recipe. So let me go into here. Now, people have also made K9 C60. If you make K9, you go in the middle of the upper band. You see, you go here, in the middle of this, which has also three bands and six states. Is this good or is this bad? When you make K9 C60, what do? You have a similar band structure, you see, it's roughly the same width, but you have many more electrons in the C60. So the system is more polarizable, and eventually the coupling lambda, you see, the coupling lambda is some coupling divided the dielectric function. If you increase the dielectric function, lambda goes down. So one would expect that by doping too much, you see, you make a more polarizable unit and you have a smaller lambda. In fact, this only gives TC of 10. If you do another game, you make this system and you add ammonia in the lattice. Ammonia basically pushes a little bit the lattice, but doesn't do anything chemically, so it doesn't change the electronic. Ammonia also goes in the direction of making the system more polarizable, because you add polarizable electron where you don't have electron. So also there you get TC of 12. So what should you do to increase? Well, you should go here, you see, because if you would go here, you see, you fill up a similar band, but below you have a less polarizable unit, okay? So I would say if you make acceptor C60 in all this framework and you are able to keep the other parameter similar, you should increase lambda. Unfortunately, the people who tried didn't manage. But this is not a surprise, because, you know, if lambda increases, the system is less stable. So I would suggest to our material friends to try a little bit harder, because the fact that up to now the system are unstable is in some sense an indication that lambda may be stronger. Of course, it's all a matter of fine-tuning a little bit, because, you know, if you profit of larger lambdas, you also go into more delicate regimes. But I think if one has a good motivation, maybe the exploration of this. So, for example, this would be a specific prediction to say it may be worth to try to prepare acceptors. So this is it. Please. Yes. Oh yes, I mean, yeah, you can get an order of magnitude easily. Yeah, because you see, the point is, well, let me maybe discuss this. This may be interesting because the basic you can understand non-numerically. Let me see if I have. Okay, well, you want to see the theory made on the back of an envelope. That's how I started. So, suppose... where is it? Okay, let's first do this exercise. Let's start from BCS, which is this one, and we do now the Migdalias in two lines, okay, instead of 50 pages. How do you do? You take the propagator with the self-energy, you write down the self-energy and expand in the standard sense, and then you plug it in like this. You see, you have 1 over z, epsilon over z, so basically you have less coherent part and a renormalized band. Now you play this trick. Whenever you have a dressed electron, this would be a dressed electron which comes in with this propagator. You see, I absorb 1 over z in a vertex. This is not a vertex correction. It's a representation of the dressed propagator. So what I do is I absorb the 1 over z into a renaming of the old vertex, like this. So that means that when I have a self-energy effect, which is this one, you see, I get a new g, which is divided by 1 plus lambda. And if it is square, it goes like the square. Now, this... instead renormalizes the Fermi velocity, and so it increases the density of states. So all in all, you see the new lambda is the old lambda divided 1 plus q. And that's the reduction of Macmillan from BCS, you see? Now, so you go from the standard equation, 1 over lambda, to this more complex equation. Now, this also brings Tc down from 150, that you could easily have with BCS, to 20 maximum. Once you do the many body, I mean, once you do the vertex, now let's do on this basis the vertex correction. Now, the vertex correction, we just say, okay, we have that we have the bare vertex, the correction, plus a function of parameters of order 1, and we got this g prime. Suppose this function is a 1, of course, it means more complex. Then we have this type of correction. Then you see the corrected thing is multiplied. So now what we get, you see, is a completely different structure which easily can bring you to very high things. Because, you see, we are doing perturbative things in the exponent. You see, this is what one should remember. So it's easy to get a factor of 10 once you modify the exponent by a factor of 2, for example. So in
how come omega over Jupiter?
Yes. Yes. No, this is in the case in which I have taken it to be 1. No, in the real formula they do. I mean, no, this is the back of the envelope. No, I have the real formula. I mean, yes. Well, I mean, clearly, it's not the 1. I mean, yes. No, it's not the 1. Here, I put the 1 just to estimate. So then what do we learn? You see, because the question is, what is perturbative? So what we learn is the following, that you see, the BCS, for example, Tc versus lambda, could be something like that, okay? And could easily give you 100, but it doesn't mean anything, because it's just to teach the student, not to do real calculation. Then you have this lowering due to self-energy, which is the Macmillan or Migdalian aspect. And then we have an increase of the same order or even more due to the vertex correction. You see this in the most favorable situation. So you may easily go into 100, you see, because you have an effect. You see, the same effect that brought you from 100 to 10, that is the many-body effect, now you may have in positive. That is, I mean, then if you want, you have to, I mean, then you have to do real calculation. But this is to give you, for example, then, let's say, with the same parameters, you see, I've taken lambda 0.3, mu star 0.1, and omega 0, 1500, just to make parameters, then I get that the TC of Macmillan will be 0.7, and the TC of the non-ideal body will be 48. So, and we believe that this is the explanation of the comparison of graphite versus C60. It's not the parameters which you fiddle, the parameters which are different. What is different is the theory. One same parameter, adiabatic theory, non-adiabatic theory. You see. Of course, then you enter into details, and that's rather... But as you see here, before details, there are mainstream lines that are reasonably well defined. So the story essentially is the following. Non-adiabaticity brings you to a different theory of superconductivity, in which correlation via the forward scattering can bring you into a favorable situation. This would be, in a nutshell, the story. Then you have to go into specific. So, as you see, this is a sort of intermediate case. I mean, you need both. You need non-adiabaticity and correlation, but in a story which is evolutive and not revolutionary. Feel that I don't like it. But I mean, people also went too far to rush for very exotic mechanisms. In any case, I have nothing against exotic or non-conventional. I mean, I like it. I just thought that there are so many people working on that, and the Migdal looked to me completely virgin, so we thought it was interesting to go in this direction, and I think it is. That's all. So, and contrary to most people who talk in this, I'm not completely sure that this is the right theory. So this is very original, you have to admit. Okay. Yeah, thank you.